No introduction would be adequate to express the feelings of ourselves and the entire Jewish community for Curtis, for what he has done, past and present and future, for our people. I would just say briefly that the concept of appreciation has two meanings. One is appreciation for what someone does for you, and the other thing is appreciation for the person himself. And the two are this time complementary. I would say that our appreciation for what you have done is only exceeded by our appreciation for you as a human being, and your courage to fight against prejudice, and for one of the most basic tenets of our Torah, that every human being is endowed with a divine element. So without any further introduction, let me give you the opportunity. Thank you. Well, beginning with I was a young man here in this stage growing up in the Depression, and forgive me, but I asked for the young children to be taken out because I've been asked to tell quite a bit of what we saw, and I'll be rather graphic this morning to give you a good idea of what we saw there in Europe. And I don't want those children to have nightmares. But as I mentioned, we grew up in the Depression and then right into the uniform during World War II. And going into the service, I was taken to Fort Knox, Kentucky in the very end of 1943, December, and given the Armed Forces training. And then when I graduated high in my class, instead of being assigned to a combat division, they sent me alone on a train to Camp Crawford, South Carolina, which was the Ranger Camp. And we received very intense training. Now, this was very, thinking back about that for a minute, was very different from the rest of the Army, because the rest of the Army, like at Fort Knox, we were all 18, 19-year-old kids, full of vim and vigor. Here now I was transferred to a different kind of outfit where we had some hand-picked young kids like myself, but an awful lot of European men who escaped from the German army, Polish men, French men, Belgium, they were all kinds of men. And there was a young man in my squad as we were training, kept calling out and saying, hurry up with the training, hurry up with the training, I got to go kill, I got to go kill. And we couldn't, as young, innocent 18-year-old kids from here, couldn't understand what heck he was talking about. At the end of the graduation, and we sat down, we were all being assigned new camps and so on, and he began to tell us that he grew up in Poland when the German army overran his country. And he, I forget, he was probably 16 or 17 at the time. And when the German army overran his neighborhood, the old men went out with old muskets even to try and stop the German army. And, of course, they were overrun and with machine guns and tanks, and they butchered them, the Germans did. For some reason or other, he was with them as a young boy, and somehow he hid in some bushes and managed to escape the massacre. He was, as far as he knew, the only one. And he went back, he didn't know what else to do after it was over, and he went back to his village to find that men all over the village had been laying around there, and they had been castrated. The women had been violated, to put it in a nice way, and left for dead, still dying, most of them. And this included all the young girls there. He came out into the village square to find his sister. I think he said she was 15. Oh, no, around 13, 14 years old. And a German company had come in and taken her and tied her over a big wooden cask, and then the entire company raped her, and then finally they stabbed her and left her to die very slowly that way. And it shocked us young Americans to hear stories like this, because we had never been exposed to anything. And now I began to understand why he wanted to go kill. To a point, I understood. We were then, our whole battalion was separated in two groups, and his group went off to learn parachute training. My group went off to Camp Hale, Colorado, and we received the mountain training and that kind of thing, skiing, rappelling, and all that. And then finally, my whole contingent was sent to Camp Maxey, Texas, to join the 99th Division as a ranger unit. Unfortunately, the infantry had no idea what rangers were and didn't know what to do with us, so they separated us and put two men in each company. And they were going to use us as strict, simple infantry instead of striking forces there. We were declared hot and sent out to the East Coast. My own battalion to Miles Standish outside of Boston, and then on board ship and across the Atlantic in the largest convoy to ever leave the States, and went to Glasgow and England, and we received a little more training there, and then across the channel in LSTs to Le Havre. And that was the first time for us to actually see what a war was like in part. Because as the ship came into the harbor, all we could see all over that harbor was nothing but rubble from the bombs, from the attack of Normandy and so on. And it was quite an incredible thing to see, nothing but rubble, piles all over the place, and our ship just pulled her nose right up on top of the rubble, and then the bow of the ship opened up, and we left the ship, and they had convoy trucks to pick us up and take us through France and into Belgium, and then finally up to what we call the Siegfried Line on the Belgium-German border. And here were thousands and thousands of pillboxes with millions of mines in between all over the place. So we were getting to get quite an education here. We relieved the 9th Infantry Division there, and as we were coming up into the forest, and there was a little hole here and a little hole over there, and all the way down through the forest out of sight, each two of us would get in a hole. The 9th Infantry men would leave and pull back behind us, and we'd ask them as green kids, well, what do we do? And also, one of the guys said, you'll see pretty soon. And that's all the instructions we got. And going up there, our sergeant had us in formation and had us drop all the packs that we had in the duffel bags with all the clothing that we had carried clean from Dallas, Texas, there. All our winter clothing and all our equipment was left behind, and we were never to see them again. And this is, let me see, this was November 3rd, my birthday, there. So it was raining, freezing rain, and sometimes snow flurries. It was quite cold at the time. In the next month and a half, we were to sit in these holes and occasionally get out and move around a little bit and go on some assigned patrols toward the enemy line and see what was going on. But we didn't realize that we were all freezing to death. During that period, I was on a patrol one day, and coming back, I couldn't understand why I kept tripping. Falling. I was a young man, just 19 years old. And when I took my boots off when we got back into our holes, and we had, mind you, no blankets or anything else, no winter gear at all, and never did see any, took my shoes off, and my feet swelled up terrible. I happened to notice that I was carrying my rifle on my arms because I couldn't, my hands were all swelled up. And I couldn't even put my finger in the gun, in the trigger housing to pull the trigger of my weapon. And in examining, of course, when I took the shoes off, the odor of my feet was terrible from the gangrene that was beginning to set in. And they took me back to the hospital for a period of time, and my legs were frozen right just below the knees, solid frozen, not trench foot, and my arms were frozen up to here, my ears and my nose and so on. And they treated me for a period of time, and all of a sudden one morning, December 16th, while I was still in the hospital, at dawn, all of a sudden we could hear all this explosions way out in the woods in front of us where our company was and our battalion. And we knew there was some kind of a big fight, but we had no idea what was going on. But also I realized that our buddy's in trouble. They're way under strength because there were so many men. When they were bringing me back on a stretcher, we passed piles of bodies of our own men frozen to death. And they just stacked them behind the lines there until they disposed of them somewhere. And I left the... I demanded the medics to go get my clothing, get my rifle. And there were 16 of us decided to go back up on the front lines and help our buddies because we knew they were in trouble. By the time I got back up and found my company in the forest and so on, the 1st Battalion that was on our right had been overrun by the Germans, and they were pretty well wiped out. And now the German army swung around and surrounded us. And it took 3 days to fight our way out and find our way out of that trap. And coming down into Kelheim, the Americans were having quite a fight with the SS troopers and the Panzers coming down the railroad bed into this town of Krinkelt. And when they saw these guys coming down at nighttime off this hill, they thought they were German infantry. And they called back behind the lines and they threw in a huge barrage of our own 155 millimeter guns, the biggest guns we had at the time. And when they come in, the whole world just blew up and kept blowing up. Of course, we instantly hit the ground. And when it was finally all over, I remember I was scared out of my head. And I remember there was a man up in front of me, one of my buddies, and I crawled over to him and I whacked him on the side of the leg. I wanted him to get up because I was too scared. And I wanted to see, have him get up and see if it was safe. And he didn't move. And I whacked him again. And finally I crawled up on him and rolled him over, and he was dead. And I crawled around, all around me there in the pitch dark, and everybody that I found was dead. My entire platoon, except for me. I was the first scout, so I was just to happen to be in, we'll say, the right position at the time. It was very emotional because all these kids I had trained with back stateside here and over in England, and then finally for about a month and a half they are up in the front lines, and now all of a sudden every one of them were dead. And I finally found one kid, and he was still moving a little bit, and his eyes were open. And I could see him at times because of there were still a lot of explosions in the air, the air burst. Around the vicinity and would light up the area. And I ran over to him now, and I picked up him up, but he was blown in half. And I had only the top half of his body in my arms, and I was crying. And I was begging him, telling him that I would save him. And yet I knew I couldn't do it. And of course, in a matter of a minute or two, he was dead in my arms. And I was covered with his blood and everything else. It was a terrible, terrible emotional shock for me. And Wadsworth come over by me, pardon me, Kellogg, and he reached out and he told me, he said, well, come on, he said, we're moving. There were others in through the darkness that had survived, only a few of us. And I looked up at him, still holding this body in my arms, and I told him, I said, we can't leave them. We can't leave them like this. And he just looked down at me and he said, He opened the eyes of this kid that was in my arms, and he says, come on. He says, he's dead. And he put his hand out, and I finally reached up, and he pulled me up. And we went through the woods, and we found others who were wounded and still alive, and we carried them individually back into the village. And as I say, it was quite an emotional shock for young men like us to lose all our buddies like that. We went back. They took us back later the next day to a place called Elsenborn, Elsenborn Heights, and we reestablished lines. And now we've established that in the company when it began, we had 264 men, including an engineer, platoons that were putting mines out and so on. And now, 3 days later, there was 18 of us, GIs left, and two officers. That's all that were left out of the whole group. And as I say, we reestablished lines, and now we would go through the Battle of the Bulge and stop the 3rd Panzer Division and wipe them out. And then gradually they began, formed what they call Hell's Corner, and we held those positions and stopped the Germans there. So they made the big bulge behind us. And gradually now in the next roughly month or more, they began slowly to collect new green men from stateside and anywhere else they could find and the rear echelon troops that were unnecessary at the time, and give them a uniform, not a uniform, but give them equipment, give them a rifle, and say, here, you're infantry now, and send them back, send them up on the front lines. I got, in this reorganization, they made me from a PFC suddenly to a staff sergeant, and now I got all this responsibility. And then I got 4 cooks, a kid that was pulled out of a college in Chicago, who was an engineer, and he outranked me. At the time, he was a tech sergeant. And I got a couple other men that did have some training there. But now we had to try to train them to shoot, to kill, to survive up in the front lines, and the snow was probably at least this deep and varied to even much deeper. Some areas, the Stars and Stripes told us that not far from us was as much as 7 foot deep of snow, and we're living out 24 hours a day in the cold. We reorganized steadily with new men coming up all the time, and I take them out on the patrols into the enemy lines to teach them how to survive and how to fight. And then finally we finished up the Battle of the Bulge and drove the Germans back, and then we attacked the Siegfried Line. In our immediate area, 5 miles deep of one row after another of concrete pillboxes as far as you could see, and mines all over the place of all kinds, and we lost a lot of men trying to get through those mines. And then we pushed into Germany and up the Siegfried, up the Cologne Plains and into the city of Cologne, and overran my own men, came to a complex with a big high stone wall with buildings with bars on them. And it was a Gestapo prison. We got quite a shock of going in those buildings. I think there was 4 or 5 big buildings with at least 4 floors in each one of them. And as we walked inside, there was catwalks, fire catwalks, those metal grates for stairs and so on, come up on platforms. The whole inside buildings were hollow except for these catwalks all over the place, and on the walls were all these small steel doors, cells. And when we began to open up these steel doors and look inside, a small room, perhaps about 6 feet to 7 feet deep at the most, and about this wide, with a wooden bunk in each one of them, and some kind of a prisoner. Men, women, and children, we began opening up these doors and seeing them had been all, by the Gestapo, had all, almost all of them that I saw were, had been tortured in many different ways, terribly, the things that they did to human beings, because the Gestapo accused them of being saboteurs, being in the underground, of God knows what accusations. They didn't have to have proof that you did something wrong to the Nazi regime. And I'm not going to go describe some of the terrible things that we saw in there, but they actually rounded up whole families that tried to help, such as Jews. There was one family back in Holland that tried to hide some Jews, and they were caught. So the Germans took the entire family, the father, the mother, and I think, there were, if I remember correctly, I think there were four small children, and they put them in separate buildings and separate floors, never to see each other again. We found the kids up on some other floors and had been tortured. And I can't understand how human beings can do things like this to others, because they consider them different. But anyway, we were suddenly pulled out of Cologne and marched south quickly to a place called Remagen. And on the second night, we went across that bridge under heavy fire, and my company was detailed to climb the Appellale on the other side, straight up, 600 feet. And we scaled that mountain and held it until the daylight, and then, of course, more troops kept coming across constantly that bridge, and we could look down and watch all the explosions and the troops running across the bridge continually there to help reinforce us and so on. And then we pushed back into what they call the Remagen Bridgehead of about 30 square miles. And here we now began to come upon these strange camps. Now our army and our people had never told us about the programs that were going on in Germany or the concentration camps that were there. So everything that we were coming upon was cold turkey. As we would come as infantry going like a wave across Germany, and we'd suddenly come to a camp, usually double rows of barbed wire and barracks inside there and so on. But we would come to them and get on the radio, what do you want us to do next, asking the officers. And they'd tell us, okay, split and go clean around the camp, meet on the other side, and re-engage the German army. That was our only mission in Europe, was to engage and destroy the German army. So as we were going around these big camps and so on, and more troops, supporting troops like the tanks and maybe sometimes the artillery trucks would catch up to us, and we'd be going around and by masses around the camps, and suddenly see a gate, and way over there, there's some of those slaves. We had no other word. We didn't have the word Holocaust or survivors in those days. So we began to call, as we overran peoples who were imprisoned in the farms and in the factories, we saw many of them as we overran Germany, we began to just simply call them slaves. So now these people in these camps behind the barbed wire, we just equalized them as slaves. And we'd see them stand there by the gates and looking at all these American troops going around. And they'd be waving to you, and they'd be smiling. And some of them would come running out to you and start shaking hands and hugging you and kissing you. And we thought they were all right. And we kept on going. And we went by a number of camps that way. Best I can remember now, at least three that I can remember. And I've learned since the war that the officers would detail just a small detail, maybe a squad. Go in the camp. See what needs to be done. But get the heck out of there and hurry up and catch up with us, because we're going to keep on moving. And this was the general attitude of camp after camp there in Germany. So one day, as we're pushing in deep into Germany, at a town of, called Diedorf, I got orders to hold up. And the jeep was waiting for me. And they took me back to regimental headquarters and into a building. And there was a other sergeants, handpicked sergeants, were being brought in from all over the regiment. And we were being given a special mission. 60 miles ahead, behind the German lines in front of us, was a city called Gießen. And it was a very old city, an ancient city. And apparently some of the high officers decided that they wanted to save the city, because every other city we came to, and every village, almost all the villages, we would throw our Air Force in on bombing to begin with, throw the artillery and destroy everything in our path, literally speaking. And now this city, they decided they wanted to try to save, but it was also on the far side of it was a network of autobahns, and that was critical to take them. My mission, they told me, was to take all my men that night and put them on top of a column of 7th Armored tanks, and we would move up real close to the German line, and then suddenly at 2 o'clock in the morning we would attack, break through the German lines, and make a run 60 miles behind the German lines. And then when we got to Gießen, the tanks would pull off into the woods, and they would hide for the night. Their mission was then the next day to circumvent the city and come up and take those autobahns and cut off the escape routes. They weren't to go into the city. My men, I took off then, and we went a short distance across country, came to the Lahn River, and this is in the dead of winter, swim the river with my men, come up on the other side quietly, and then there was a bridge there. That was my mission, was to take that bridge. And we would take all the German guards off quietly and take care of the engineers and eliminate them, and then cut the cords to the bridge, to the explosives on the bridge, and hold that bridge all night. Now, we were soaking wet. And all I can remember is hiding in the doorways of some of the buildings and so on until dawn, when the whole regiment would come charging in. And I remember all my clothing freezing and sticking to my whole body. And of course, with all my men was the same way. We took two men, and we took the uniforms off, coats and helmets off, two of the German dead, and they pretended to be the German guards on the bridge out in the open, so we wouldn't draw any attention from the German people or army inside. And we completed our mission. That dawn, the entire regiment come charging in on all those bridges that the other teams also took, and come charging in the middle of the city, and we had very little fighting because we were right in the middle of the German troops that were supposed to be defending the city. The day before, en route to the, Gießen, I was riding on the hull of the first tank, and we come up on a knoll, a rise, and suddenly here's a city in front of us, and we stop, and the captain come out of the, his hatch, and we were looking at a map determining where we were. It was called a place called Hadama. We, of course, never heard of this place before. But as we looked out there, this entire city had been previously bombed and firebombed. And it was total destruction as far as we could see in every direction. But on the far side, there was another hill. And that whole hill, we were up apparently rather high so we could really see this. This whole hill was surrounded by a very high stone wall, perhaps 20 feet high. And there was a gate. And inside that big wall was a whole series of big old masonry buildings. The main building, apparently, had a big giant Red Cross flag draped over the roof and tied on it. So we knew it was a hospital. And not a bomb had been dropped on those buildings. They were untouched. And yet all this destruction in front of us was such a contrast. That main building had a big chimney, and apparently it was low pressure that day, and this brown, heavy brown smoke was pouring out of the out of the chimney, and it was laying down all over the city and over us, and there was the most appalling odor that we had ever smelled. Now, we had been in combat for quite some time. We thought that we had experienced all the terrible things of war and the odors of war, the burning flesh and the death everywhere we went. But this was something very different. And the captain finally told me, he said, I'm not moving my tanks through that area until you clean the area out of Panzerfaust, the one-shot anti-tank weapons. And the Germans handed them out to a lot of civilian men and everything else, and they'd hide in the rubble until a tank went by and bam, blow the tank up, and four or five men were dead just like that in a split second. So I took my men, and I had to clean out those buildings up there, too. So we began going through all the rubble and part of an open street that the Germans had cleared the rubble, and we tried to find pieces of rags in the rubble to hold over our face so we could breathe as we proceeded toward this building, or series of buildings. And we came to the wall and the big gate, put TNT against it and blew the gate in, and then we charged up the hill. As we get up to the buildings, on my right was three or four one-story wooden barracks that had been built during the war, very different contrast to all the big masonry buildings. And in front of those wooden barracks was a large group of slaves. But these slaves were very different from anything we had seen yet. The condition was so absolutely appalling, and I'll have to keep using this word appalling here in this place. I looked at them very close. You could smell them from the body odors and everything else from them from quite a distance. And I looked at them. They were nothing but human skeletons. There was no flesh on their bodies. Their eyes were sunken way back in their heads. There was no hair. All the hair had been shaved off them. The uniform was a blue and white striped uniform, but you could hardly see the coloring at all of the stripe because they were so filthy. And I knew they were no danger to me and my men. So I turned around and my men ordered them into the buildings, find the German soldier and shoot him or kill him or take him prisoner. And a few minutes later, one of my men came for me. You better come with me. Now this hospital compound was, as we were to learn, was set up under the Germans or the Nazi doctors all over Germany under what they call the T4 program of euthanasia. In the early days, in the early 30s, when they were taking power and so on, they had set up programs and purged the German doctors of those who would not participate in these new ideas of the Nazis and the experimentation on human beings and the eugenics and all that. And then they set up a program called the eugenics that was more or less taken from here in this country in the 20s, where they rounded up people who were mentally ill and deformed from diseases and this kind of thing, and they were of no value to the new order, Third Reich. And they would take and sterilize them in the early days. But soon the Nazi doctors realized that these people were still a burden. Incidentally, I was told many times, that these people were sterilized, most of them, without anesthesia, men and women. And they rounded these people up and they, as I say, they sterilized them, but they were still a burden to the state because the state had to feed them and clothe them and take care of them. And that wasn't a solution for what they wanted. So they, according to the Nazi doctors and their documentation, they improved into what they called T4 of eugenics. of euthanasia. And so what they began to do was to collect these kind of people all over Europe, and then all over Germany, and then all over the European countries that the German army was overrunning, and bring them into all these T4 hospitals, and then euthanize them. And thus they were no burden to the state. Now, as I was brought into the main building, we went into the main hall, and here, and I'm going to have to skip an awful lot of things, but I'll give you a pretty good general idea of what we found there. There was a chaotic situation here, because there was a great many people walking around in white johnnies, very different from the slaves that I saw outside. And they were walking around wondering, what happened? Where did the hospital staff go? They disappeared. Of course, I was taken up. Now, in every camp and hospital and whatever that I went into, always some of the so-called slaves would come up to me, and we would get talking, and they find out that we were Americans. They would, some of them begin to speak English to me, and from that point on, they were self-assigned interpreters for me. And so they began to take me down through the halls, and they brought me over to the office where, or one of my men, I can't remember, to where Dr. Walmer and the other doctors were in their office. And I interrogated Dr. Walmer, the head of the hospital at the time, a very large man, a very ugly looking man. And when I determined who and what he was, then I was satisfied. I placed him under military arrest, and all the doctors put a guard on the door and told him to stay there. And then we found the nurses in the next room waiting for us. And then we began, you might say, a tour with some of the slaves through this building. And they would begin to explain what was going on here. And on the first floor, as we went deeper into the building, there were wings, and these were the wards. And the wards, people were brought in, now at this stage of the war, who were different, as the Germans considered them, as inferior, as subhuman. And I can give you a list, pages long, of the Gypsies, the Jews, and the Slavs, and all this kind of thing, but there were all kinds of people here. But these people were not like what was originally here, the mentally ill and the deformed. They were simply people who were considered different and collected up all over Europe and brought in here to be euthanized. And on these wards, they were the Germans doctors were very careful to collect them, let them think that they were actual patients in a hospital, put them in usually at least two big giant buses from wherever they were coming from, and bring them to Hadamar from all over Germany in every direction, and then bring them into the hospital, give them a white johnny, assign them a bed. Now on this first floor, as they described to me, that the doctors and nurses would come through in the morning, check out and choose a ward or a series of wards or the whole floor. And a little while later, the nurses would come in, and they would bring on wheels these carts with trays. The trays were just about as tall as I was, as I remember, and they were full of hypodermic needles. And at this stage of the war, they were using, and I could smell them. I walked over to the trays and could smell them, full of benzene, gasoline. And they would inject in every man, woman, and child in that designated area into the artery, that benzene. And they explained to me that earlier they were using massive doses of morphine, and there was a couple other chemicals, but it was appalling to me. And doctors have told me in this country after the war that when I told them that story, they can't imagine anything more painful, excruciating, than to have gasoline go to your heart like that. And the upper floor, the next floor up, here the wards, all over the place in the beds, everything clean and immaculate like a hospital should be, but these people in the beds, and they were assign the beds as patients and so on, and then the nurses and doctors would shut off all food and water and starve them to death. And it was so heartbreaking to walk through these wards and see these people in this terrible condition. Trying to remember some of the details, but I left that particular area, and one of my men came for me. He said, better come with me. And he led me back downstairs again. And then we went down a narrow little stairwell down to the basement. In the basement, as the first sight I saw, was these big, huge stone columns that were supporting the building. But on the long wall, there was big, huge oak doors, typical of Europe. But there was one door that was steel, and it was black, a very dark charcoal color. And I walked over to that door, and head height was a round piece of glass through the door, and I looked in. And it was a shower room. This door was very much like a steel door on a ship. It could, but it could only be opened from the outside. And as I looked inside, I could see a black and white ceramic checkerboard ceramic floor, and off-white ceramic walls to the ceiling, and a concrete ceiling just about this height, and shower heads up there. So we opened the door, and the odor here was absolutely appalling. There was no bodies or no people in this room, and we didn't understand what we were seeing. But in this whole room was urine, blood, vomit, all over the room, and human waste, and on the walls. And one of the men called out to me. He said, "What the hell is going on around here?" I said, "I have no idea." A minute or so later, another man called out the same thing. "What's going on around here?" And I looked at him, "What's the matter?" And he was standing in the hallway, and he reached up and he grabbed this iron wheel that was a part, controlled a valve overhead, and he turned it, and he said, "There's no water." And instantly I looked in the room, and I looked at the shower heads. There was no water coming out. And one of the slaves came over, and there was slaves all over the place following me everywhere at the time, and a few of my men were wherever I was going. One of the slaves came over, and he began to tell us, and the hospital, head of my hospital has given me a huge book in German just a few years ago of this. It is now a museum, and with a lot of the details of this, and verifying what he told me. He said the hospital staff would take approximately 50 people standing up and force them into that room until they could force no more in, and close the door and lock it. And then the doctor, now doctor only, was permitted to turn the carbon monoxide on. And it took up to 2 hours to kill everybody in the room. And we left there and we went to the next room, which was quite a large room, much larger than this, probably twice the size of this room. And this room contained tables, long tables and benches. And somebody had been in here, and the tables were compacted off a little bigger than this, with boards this way, about that high, 4, 5, 6 inches. And somebody had been in this room and been gathering, sorting, and counting thousands and thousands of wedding rings, thousands and thousands of diamond rings and other small jewelry, and other compartments with thousands and thousands, as I remember, of gold, of human teeth with gold fillings. There was nobody in the room at this time. They had vacated. We couldn't quite understand what this was all about. And we left there, and now I went out into the main part of the cellar, where all these big stone pillars were. And they formed like cubicles in between them. And in those cubicles were piles of human bodies, all thrown on top of each other, men, women, and children, all with clothing on. And one of the slaves just said, they haven't been processed. And I didn't know what he meant by that at that point. And farther down the building, there was a wall, and there was a door. And the door was open. And I walked down there. And the odor here was absolutely appalling. As I stepped in the doorway, all on my left side, all the way down the room, was a huge pile of human beings, men, women, and children, all totally nude, thrown on top of each other, laying there. These were processed, as one of the men told me. And then he described to me that all those bodies out there would be processed. All the clothing would be taken off of them. All the jewelry would be taken off of them. The teeth with gold fillings would be pulled out of them. Every body cavity would be searched for hidden jewelry or whatever. All the hair on the body everywhere would be shaved off. They were processed and thrown in that room. And now at the end of that room was a battery of ovens. And I remember walking through that room and toward one oven that was open in particular that drew my attention. And as I stood in front of that oven and looking in and looking at the bodies burning, and another man come up and he looked at me and he said, Monsieur? And he turned around and he looked into the oven and he started to cry. And he said, they, meaning the hospital staff, would throw small children and babies alive in there. And then he began to sob and he cried his heart out and he fell down on his knees on the floor. And I left him there. And there were other scenes in there, but I'm going to skip them. And I went upstairs and went out into the courtyard. And here were a great many European four-wheel hay wagons. And there were push carts. All the males were thrown on their wagons, and the females and children were thrown on their wagons. And I walked over close to them, not saying a word, trying to understand what we're seeing. And look at these heads that were toward me. They were thrown in every irregular position. But there was no sign of bullet wounds or stabs or anything like that. It was apparent that they had been gassed or euthanized with the benzene. And I turned my attention more or less off to my left, and there was a huge pile of human hair. And I quietly slung my rifle, and I walked over and I put my hand up like this. My hand didn't reach the top of that pile of human hair. And as they explained to me that they shaved all the hair off the bodies of the victims, and they made that pile, and now they would turn that pile over to the manufacturers in Germany to make mattresses, winter clothing for the soldier, and winter mittens out of human hair. Beside that, to the right, was another pile of human eyeglasses. And I walked over and I quietly just put my hand up like that. And I stood there looking at that pile of eyeglasses, trying to understand how many human beings does this represent. Because not everybody wears eyeglasses. It was just overwhelming. Off in the background was piles of shoes, piles of suitcases, piles of clothing, all neatly separated as the Germans did everything. They would all be turned over to the manufacturers to make something new. They didn't waste anything. I was taken off to a small building. There was many buildings here we went through and so on. And all of them had wards and that kind of thing. But this one was a special building. And as I entered the main lobby, there was quite a large group of very obvious mentally ill human beings and very obvious deformed from diseases or whatever human beings. And they explained to me that in the early days
under the eugenics program, the doctors had collected all these people from Germany and then from the occupied countries, and they eventually euthanized them all over Europe, except this one group that they kept alive all these years for one purpose: propaganda. The German photographers would come in and take pictures of these people because they were so obviously ill, shall we say. And I was appalled at what I was hearing and seeing. And I left that building. I went back through the other buildings and out to the main, in front of the main building, toward the slaves that I first saw. And as I walked across the yard, I called out to them, "Does anybody speak English?" And finally, one man answered me, much like a zombie. And he said, "Yes." So I approached him and I addressed him. I said, "We are American soldiers. It's all over. Do you understand what I'm saying to you?" Now, mind you, we're 60 miles behind the enemy lines here. So nobody really expected any Americans to be in the region at that time. Except apparently the doctors were warned about us coming somehow. He didn't answer me, but he began crying. And he looked over my shoulders at some of my men up in the second or third story window yelling out there. And he began to sob. And he again, like the man down in the basement, fell down on his knees and he cried his heart out. But this time I stayed there. And I waited for him to regain his composure. And now I began to look over this group of slaves in this appalling condition. Human skeletons with no flesh in the body. No hair in the body, and I remember one man in front of me had no sleeve. And then I could see the open running sores from the apparent lice bites and so on. But I now knew that this group, I could see in the filth of the uniforms, I could see a few yellow Star of David. And I knew that this group was what I called, for lack of any other word, the burial detail, the body handling detail. And I also knew that they would be euthanized very soon because they were eyewitnesses to everything that was going on. We found up on the hill cemeteries. One big, huge cemetery. Pardon me. They had different crosses of the different religions, the crosses as far as I could see. And under one, every single cross was from 20 to 25 bodies under them. And this whole cemetery here, surrounded by a stone wall, was nothing but children. They had other big cemeteries all over there. One place that we were brought to was a huge hole, much bigger than this hole of this room here. We come over to the edge and stood there and looked in to see bodies all thrown in there on top of each other. And we just left that area. And we left the camp. I'm going to try to push on to some of the other places now. Oh, when I went, was talking first before I left and talking to the slaves, and I told them that we are Americans. And it's all over. And he cried his heart out. And finally, when he regained his composure again, that he then was still on his knees, he began speaking several languages and telling the group there that we were Americans, not the German soldier. And we left that place, and I completed my mission at Giessen. And then the whole regiment turned and went north into the Ruhr pocket. And we found a camp up there called Hemmer. All barbed wire. The worst ones we did see in that camp were the Russians. Men and women in that compound. Behind barbed wire with guards. And what they were doing to the Russians in particular, once they brought them into the prison, shut off all food and water, just like Hadamar. Only the German guards like to play games. And when they were in a terrible condition of starvation, the German guards would occasionally throw out a morsel of food, a piece of bread or whatever, into the yard and wait and watch these Russians stand there looking at that morsel of food down on the ground. And finally, when they couldn't resist it anymore, and some of them would run out to grab that piece of bread, the German soldier would open up and shoot and kill them before they could get to the bread. A daily game for them. We completed that battle up there, and we turned and headed south, due south through the heart of Germany, to Bamberg and Nuremberg area. And now we were in the First Army all this time. We would now join the Third Army, and the Seventh Army was coming in on our right, and from northern France. And now we would line up clean across Germany. I don't know how many divisions there were there, quite a lot of us. And we would now push into Bavaria in the heart of the concentration camps. And we were to head for Austria. And now we were down around Kelheim area. And I had my men, we were going in squad formation. They were. I had two scouts in front of me. I would be a third man. The rest of the men were following behind me. And now, as we went through the forest, we could hear some cries and some strange noises up ahead of us. So I ordered my men skirmish, get out beside me on both sides, and we were walking a straight line toward that noise. And suddenly we came to a road that was going across in front of us. And there was a small field on the other side and then totally surrounded by a forest. But on the road was an incredible numbers of a huge column of prisoners, of slaves. And the German guards and the dogs were beating them to death and bayoneting them and raping the women. And there were cries all over the place. And I was so shocked at what I was seeing. And again, really not understanding what the heck is going on in this area, what in this country, as a matter of fact. And I just stepped out of the woods, and I put my hands up, and I waved to the slaves, because I knew I couldn't speak their languages and so on, and I waved to them, lay down, lay down. And immediately the German guys started shooting at us, and we opened up on them. And we shot every one of those German guys that we could find. And we chased some of them across the field. And then I got on the radio and I called company, and I knew the whole company was on my left side out in the woods somewhere, and told them what they were coming upon. 1994, I believe it was the dedication of the Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C., and they brought me down there as a special guest of honor. And I've contributed quite a bit of things to the museum. And while we were going through the museum the day before it opened, there's a grand tour, and I had quite a number of my historian friends and researchers. And of course, there were thousands of survivors today were going through with us. And we come down into the Hall of Witness, and all of a sudden Benjamin Meade come over to me, and he was complimenting me on my work for the museum and all that kind of thing. And all of a sudden one of the men that was with us, a younger man, Jim Strong, came up, and he looked over us. He said, "All of you guys come with me." He said, "There's a woman downstairs who's looking for Kurt Whiteway of the 99th Division." So we all, including Benjamin Meade, went down. And in this big room, which is today is the room for all the children's drawings and pictures and so on that were in the concentration camp, that was bare at that time, and it was filled with survivors. And I was wondering what was going on, expecting to meet a survivor. And all of a sudden, a young woman in the crowd cried out there, "There he is, there he is," and she come charging through the crowd, and I was dumbfounded. I couldn't figure out why was she looking for me. She's not a survivor, not of our age. And she come over and she started hugging the heck out of me and kissing me and everything else. And then finally she stepped back and she looked at me. She said, "You liberated my father." It was in the death march from Flossenbürg of 16,000 prisoners being taken cross-country to Dachau, the master camp at Dachau. There were 209 Dachaus down here. And she was in charge of all the computers in the museum and access to all the archives. She went researching the story for her father, and she found the documents that were turned in from by the army. Staff Sergeant Kurt Whiteway and his men came upon the Flossenbürg march and dispatched the guards. That simple enough. So that's how I knew which column that was. Anyway, we left that column. Now, as we overran these places, we're combat infantry. Our only mission is to fight the German soldier. We could do nothing else but radio back and tell those behind us to come in here and help them. And we had to lead these people on the roads that were wounded and dying and crying and that kind of thing, which is heartbreaking. And we continued on. And now we're going up a mountain. And as we come up over the mountain, again we were in squad formation, and most of the men behind me. And again, all of a sudden we get this terrible odor of Hadamar. And now we could hear, way down in the forest somewhere below us, we could hear some talking and some crackling noise. So I ordered my men again to skirmish, and we walked together down through the forest and suddenly came to a huge field. And on there were three details there that I saw. The one detail of prisoners in front of me. And there was another big detail of slaves bringing up a bunch of hay wagons. They were pushing. There was no horses. And they were all pushing these wagons full of bodies. And there was another detail out here coming in out of the forest, and they were carrying 6-foot logs. The first detail in front of me were taking lay down logs and lay a row of bodies across, and a row of logs and bodies, and build them up as high as they could reach, all over this field. And most all of them were on fire. And I was so shocked, I didn't say a word. I just motioned for my men, "Go get them, bring them up to me." And when they were all standing in front of me, I just simply said, "Wo ist der deutsche Soldaten?" And they just pointed down. Where is the German soldier? And they just pointed down. Because, again, the Europeans spoke all kinds of languages. So I ordered one man to take these prisoners behind me, and we would go down to the valley floor. And as we got down there, all of a sudden, there's a city off to my left. And I can't remember now, but it was being attacked either by our bombers or by artillery or whatever. So I turned my attention well off to my right, down the same road coming out of the city, right into the camp. And there's a double row of barbed wire and the guard towers and the dog kennels on the outside. We attacked the area, and I sent men up the guard towers, destroyed the machine guns so they wouldn't be used behind us, make sure there's no guards up there. Sent the inside row, I understood it had something like 90,000 volts of electricity in it. So I detailed two men go over there, find the transformer, and blow it up. Once that was done, we all headed for the gate and charged inside and dispersed. Goggle Eye and I ran off to the left, and I landed on my knees, and I'm watching my men cover each other. And now I could look over behind the first set of barracks. And there was a large group of men, I'm assuming, hanging. But they were kicking. They were alive for some strange reason. So I pointed to two of my men over here, "Go over there and cut them down." In combat, we normally didn't speak much at all. Everything was hand signal. Goggle Eye and I charged the barracks door, and I head first. I just dived into the door and crashed it in, come up, all ready to engage a German guard inside. In here, there was no guard. There was bunks. There was a walkway all the way down on the right-hand side, and there was bunks, three tiers, as I remember. And there was all these men facing me with their heads across the bunks. This barracks, and I'm going to bypass it because it wasn't a terrible barracks, but in here they had just been replaced with new so-called prisoners of slaves. The barracks had been emptied with all the dead, and they were up on the field being burned. So what they were doing was putting these people in the barracks, in the bunks, and chaining them with log chains on the ankle and shutting off all food and water. So we left that barracks and we went into the second barracks. And as I opened the door, now I knew we wouldn't be engaging the deathhead SS troopers we had expected in this camp. And so I simply walked in this door. And as I stepped in the doorway, the odor just hit me terrible. But there was a strange, a terrible feeling here instantly. All of a sudden there was a cry, a moan, and in many languages of people begging. And hands, I could see hands out there begging me in all kinds of languages. And it was so appalling, and I can't adequately describe it, but Chico fell down on his knees beside me, and he's making the sign of the cross, and he's saying prayers. And somebody directly behind me was swearing and promising revenge. I wanted to find out what it was like for a German guard, strangely enough, here. So I took and slung my rifle, and I stood erect, and I marched like a guard, like I thought a guard would do, all the way down the barracks and all the way back. And as I did, I saw hundreds of hands. There were men and women in this barracks, all chained in the bunks, and they had their hands out, and they were following me down, speaking all kinds of languages and begging for food and water down and all the way back. I've now learned, as an additional point here, that from the survivors that have contacted me, especially in the last couple of years, and called me because of a Newsweek story, and we compared stories together to verify that we were in the same camp. But they told me for the first time that everybody in this camp and the nine other camps, there was a series of 10 camps to this Dachau 3B system, that they were all Hungarian Jews, Greek Jews, and there were some French and Belgian Jews here. And as I say, it was so emotional in this barracks to have them following me like this and begging me, and I couldn't help them except to have ordered the men to go over there and shoot the locks and unchain them. And all of a sudden, we could hear an awful ruckus outside. And we charged out both doors. And the slaves that were going with me did the same. And here, Hopper and Riggs had gone into a barracks way over on the right. And they found 20 German SS women in uniform. Big, powerful women. Well-fed. That upset me very much, looking at all these slaves in this camp and the deplorable condition that they were in. And they marched these women in two ranks across the yard toward me as prisoners. And all of a sudden now, here from the whole camp, was a sea of humanity, of men and women in this particular camp. And they saw those SS women, and they just charged the women. They were going to try to tear them apart with their bare hands. The air was full of electricity. And I yell out to my men, all of them, we'll form a line between them and hold our rifles horizontal and try to hold this crowd back. And I called out to Applegate, get these women out of this camp, get them out of sight so I can get control of the crowd. And Whitey Halls and his men were going by the main gate we came in, and he come charging in with his men to help us hold this crowd back. As we tried to hold them back, and I yelled out there and put my hands up, and I said, there's not going to be any more killing. It's all over. Do you understand? And they kind of calmed down a little bit. and they began to chatter in amongst the crowd. And what they were doing was finding somebody that could speak English. And a little Jewish woman, I didn't know she was a woman, because of her appalling condition. She had a uniform on that was seemed to be way oversized because her body had shrunken so terribly under it from terrible starvation. She had no breasts. They were consumed by her body. And she looked just like my finger, straight. No hair on her head. And she cried out. And she said, "Hey, those women." And she began to relate a story. Those women, each day, would take a group of us, approximately 20, and they march us across the yard in two columns, surrounded by SS women and killer dogs. And on the other side of the camp, there was slip trenches. And one SS woman would get down, kneel down in front of the slip trench. And mind you, these people were in deplorable condition. They were just human skeletons. They could not resist. And this SS woman would reach up and grab the first two by the back of the neck or the head, force them on their knees, force them to bend over and push their faces into human waste and hold them there and smother them to death. And all the SS women would be laughing all the time. It was a daily game. And meanwhile, the column of prisoners would have to stand there and watch this and know that in the next few minutes that this was going to happen to them, each and every one of them. And it began, somebody else in the crowd spoke up and told me that in the wintertime that the SS would choose a man or a woman and take them to the showers and give them a hot shower, and while still nude, take them out into the middle of the snowstorm in the yard and command them to kneel down or sit down there. And then they command a pack of dogs to form a circle around them and stand on alert. And the SS would go inside the barracks, and then they would stand in the window and watch. And that victim would have to sit there and not move and freeze to death. And if she or he moved, then the dogs would instantly attack and tear them apart and kill them. And they related one story after another like this, and some of them got much worse. And I finally just put my hands up and I said, I've heard enough. I don't want to hear any more. You're free. Do you understand? You're free. And apparently a little Frenchman began to sing somewhere in front of me, the Marseillaise, very hoarsely. And a few others in the crowd began to join in with him. And now the electricity seemed to disappear in the air, and the crowd began to calm down. And now they would begin to look at each other and turn around, and some with a slight smile, many of them with tears. And they look at each other and they reach out and start to hug and kiss each other and start shaking hands. And they began to sing other European songs I didn't know. And others would lock their arms and begin to sway and sing together. And this was the moment that they realized that they were liberated. And while this was all going on, and the Americans, my men, were all standing in a straight line here now and relaxed, and slinging our rifles and whatever. And all of a sudden, I perceived no signal. And that whole crowd of singing and swaying and all this kind of thing and hugging each other suddenly just stopped and froze. And we looked at each other. What's going on? Seemed like an eternity. And all of a sudden, that whole crowd just charged us and surrounded us and began hugging and kissing all of us and shaking hands all at the same time. I can't really describe the emotion here. And in the middle of it, Hopper or Bob Riggs came for me. "You better come with me." So I left this group. And we went over into the barracks where the SS women were taken. And they were waiting for us. We were to find out later that the SS Deathhead SS men had taken when they saw us coming in the front. They took prime prisoners out the back gate and they disappeared. The SS women knew that they couldn't engage us in combat or anything else, so they just sat in the barracks and waited to be arrested. As I was brought into this barracks, it was what we call a day room in the Army. When you're off duty, there's these buildings all around camp that you can go in, sit down, read, relax, write letters home. There were tables and chairs, lamps, that kind of sort of thing. This room was one of those. But I was so shocked at what I saw. I first walked down the far end, and there was a hallway on the right. And I looked in. Off the hallway was the individual bedrooms of these women. And I looked in each room. And the beds were on the right-hand side, neatly made, military style. The uniforms were all hung up on the left in military style. Nothing was wrong. Everything was immaculate. And I come back into the room, and now there were many, some of my men and many of the camp slaves in there, all looking around, nobody talking. There were tables all over the room, and on the tables were lamps. Every one of them were different in size and shape and so on. The lamps themselves were made of human heads, sexual organs, male and female, somehow preserved, parts of human bodies. The lamp shades, all different, were made of human skin with tattoos. There were many artifacts that I'm not going to describe. On the upper walls, all the way around, were framed pictures. Every frame was different, made of human skin with tattoos. Chest high, all the way around the room, was a shelf perhaps about that wide, as I can remember. This was, in my mind to this day, is what I think of as a trophy room, because the SS women had taken sexual organs, male and female, cut out and cut off, and preserved them somehow. They were all a very strange yellowish-brown color. And they mounted them from the smallest to the up to the biggest and would start all over again, all over the room around here, of breasts and sexual organs. Some of the things that happened in that room were very shocking. One of my men was standing looking at something on the shelf, and he just motioned, "Come over here." So I walked over and I was looking. It was just a hairy blob. I was 19 years old. I didn't know what it was. And I just shrugged my shoulder. And one of the slaves come over. "You don't know what that is?" I said, "No." And he said, "That is a woman's crotch. They had cut out of her. Out that door, they held her down on the ground, and they did that, and they preserved it somehow and put it on that shelf. And then they ordered the other slaves or prisoners to stand there and watch her slowly die, and they were ordered not to go near her or help her. Of course, I don't know what they could do to ever help her." And by now, I looked around some of my men, and we were all crying. A lower shelf, all the way around the room, were hundreds of human heads that had been cut off and mounted on that shelf, all the way around the room. And it got worse, if you can imagine, somehow. And I'm going to avoid the rest of it. And Chico came for me. "You better come with me." And I left that room and left everybody there, and went out in the yard again. And now we were walking over toward a small building, and there was a red cross painted on the wall by the doors, I remember. Big Chief, an Apache Indian, a very large man. Nobody in the company could pronounce his name, so we called him Big Chief. And I called out to him, "Chief, what do you got here?" And he turned around and he looked at me with the most god-awful look on his face. And his lips were quivering. He was trying to say something, but he couldn't do it. And he took a giant step to the side. And I stepped in the doorway. This room and the building looked very much like a Red Cross building in this country in the summertime to teach swimming. But as I stepped inside, off to my left was a long counter. And on the wall was all kinds of doctor's tools hanging there. There was a sink. They had a board of some kind erected, much like a heavy piece of plywood, erected straight up and down. And they took a slave, a man, and they totally stripped him. The doctors did. And they made him stand against the board like this. And they drove spikes through his elbows and his wrists and nailed him to that board. And then they took a scalpel and they cut his vocal cords so he couldn't cry or scream or talk. And now on the floor beside him, I saw this big, long drill thing with a saw blade about that big. And they took and they cut his rib cage off. They didn't cut anything other than the rib cage. And the rib cage was on the counter beside him. And some of his intestines were hanging out, so they hung them on nails beside him. And he's standing there looking at me, and I'm looking at his lungs and his other insides pulsating. And he's standing there looking at me with his beady eyes, pleading for me to help him somehow. We had no medics with us. And I didn't know what to do. And I turned around and looked in the room. And now a lot of the prisoners or slaves were in here, and a few of my men. We've since determined, talking with some of my men in the last few years before they died, and we determined that we hadn't been showered or cleansed for something like about 3.5 months. So we were very ripe. And the prisoners here all had diseases and on them. As I say, many of them with running sores and filth. And I ordered everybody, I thought about diseases, and I ordered everybody to get the hell out of this room. And I told Goggle Eye to get on the radio and radio back and see they could get some kind of a hospital unit down here right away. And I left that room. And I left him there. And I have no idea to this day what happened to him. Because I was now involved in many other things in other buildings and around the camp. And I eventually rejoined the crowd that was singing out here and hugging each other, still many of them. And while I was standing there for a few minutes, and I happened to think, if we come in, looking through the barbed wire, all over the yard was bodies, and some of them were still alive. They were everywhere around here. But we had ignored them because we were looking for the SS troopers in danger. And now I remember that over here somewhere, there was a man laying there. Why I chose him in my mind, I have no idea. But I turned, and the crowd parted. And I walked over there, and eventually I came to him. And the crowd would part in behind me, fold in behind me again. And he was laying there nude. And he was a human skeleton. There was no flesh on his body. And I reached down as a young soldier, and I picked him up in my arms, and I could hardly feel him. And I started walking off, and the crowd would part again. And I was crying my heart out. And I wanted to do something, anything, to help him. And I stopped, and I said, where the hell am I going? And I turned, and there's a barracks over there. So I faced that way, and the crowd would part again, and I finally made it to the barracks, and I had him still in my arms. And I came to the door, and I kicked the door in, and I gently laid him on the floor, because I didn't want him out there in the yard amongst all that filth and human waste and everything else in the cold ground. But that's all I could do. We knew that we couldn't give these people even a cracker from our K rations if we had some in our pockets. We had already previously made that mistake and learned that if you, in that stage of starvation, that if you gave them a morsel of food, you would put them in convulsions, and they would roll on the ground and die horribly in front of you, which happened back up north there, and I never forgot that. So here we were with all this terrible scenery and smells and things that are happening in this camp, and knowing that you couldn't do any more than just simply cut them down, unchain them, and tell them that they were free. There were many, many other horrors here. But I'm going to go on to a couple other things. We left the camp. I got orders to move out and go help the battalion fight for the city. And as I walked, round up all my men, and we began to walk down the road out of the camp toward the city on the same main road, all of a sudden I turned around and all the slaves are following me. And I said, wait a minute, hold up. I said, you can't come with us. We're going in there, we're going to be a lot of shooting, there's going to be some killing, you're going to get hurt. You're not going with us. But the mood of that whole entire crowd, I knew I couldn't stop them. And I only had 16 men. So then I thought, well, all right, come along with us. But I said, I'll let you go find the German soldier. But they're my prisoners. You bring them to me, you don't harm them. And you put them, and I chose a place once we get into the city and the building. And they were to bring the prisoners to me. All of a sudden, a woman, a German woman, come out of one of the first buildings. And she come running over to me, and she was crying. And she grabbed me by the shirt, and she locked her hands into my shirt. And she began telling me, we didn't know. I didn't know that she was speaking English. And through the conversation, she identified herself as a teacher. She had been come from Cincinnati or Cleveland, Ohio, in the earlier days. And she didn't know about this. And I turned while she's telling me these stories, and she's still hanging on to me, and I turned and looked back over. The European peoples, these slaves and so on, are smaller than we are. And I could look over the top of them, and I could look, see the camp, and I could see the guard towers, and I could still see the ropes from where I was standing then. And I turned around, and I slapped her hard across the face, and I called her a goddamn liar. And she just cried, and she let go of me, and she slid down the ground. And I told everybody, I said, don't harm her, leave her alone. And we proceeded into the buildings. And I told them, okay, everybody go find me the German soldier. And they charged all the buildings. And they searched all the rooms and the closets and wherever there was hiding spaces. And began finding the German soldier with my men. And they would bring him out to me, and they were kicking and spitting at him, calling them all kinds of obscene names, but they threw them on the ground in front of me. And these men were cowering there. And as the crowd started to get mad, I would turn around to them and tell them again, because I didn't want any to lose control. And I'd tell them, go find me some more soldiers. And when they did, then I'd find one of my men, detail them, take all these prisoners, get them the hell out of here, get them back and turn them over to the MPs. But I managed to at least keep control of the situation here. And finally, we're on the other side of the city. And I got orders now, the whole company is going to, a battalion is going to move up into the forest. And this was just starting to get dark. So I turned around to the slaves, and I told them, now, all of you go back to the camp. Because once the German army finds out that we've taken this town, they're going to shell their own people. They're going to destroy the city. You'll be safer back at the camp. So they finally they hugged me and kissed me and things like that, and then they agreed, and they turned around and they started wandering back to the camp. And we went up on the forest and on the mountain. And somewhere well up on there, and it was totally dark by now, we dug in for about 2 hour nap. And then we got up and we moved over the top of the mountain. Coming down the other side of the mountain in the pitch darkness, and way down in the valley. Now, these mountains were very, very steep, and so that we could hear these cries and these other strange noises way down there somewhere, but they were echoing off all the hills, and we couldn't tell really where the sound was coming from. But I ordered my men skirmish, get out beside me. And we walked all night down the steep mountain. And just as it was starting to crack dawn, we were down near the bottom, and there was a dirt road. And almost immediately on the other side of the dirt road, the mountain went up again. And this road in this very narrow valley wound down through the valley and off to my left. And here was the Death Head SS troopers that had taken the prime prisoners out of the camp. And now they had the prisoners on the road, and they were beating them. They were bayoneting them, and they were raping them like the other column. And we got down as close as we could, and now it was getting pretty light. And when we got within range, I gave the order to open fire. And we shot every guard we could find. And then we got up on the road, and I sent the men out on both directions of the road and chased the rest of the SS troopers down and killed them. And here again was the frustration with all these people wounded, otherwise crying, sitting on the road in unbelievable conditions. And we could do nothing but tell them to stay here. We radioed back for somebody to come down and help them. And then we were ordered to turn and go off to our left, down the valley, and all of a sudden it opened up. And we met the whole company now. And we on the far side was some hills, small hills, and there was German soldiers and SS troopers and some Wehrmacht people up there. And they had several artillery guns and some AK-AK guns, and they pointed them right at us and opened up. And we, of course, spread it out as much as we could, and we just overran those positions. And I had two green men that had been given from stateside the day before, and they were totally green. And I saw them off by one of the artillery guns, and they had taken three SS men, the SS wore different uniforms than the Wehrmacht and so on. And I see they took these three men prisoner. But one SS had his hands down like this, very low. And I called out from where I was, and I fired a shot at his feet. And I yelled out there, "Hans Hawk, put your hands up." And then I quickly moved over to where they were. And as I approached my two green men, I said, "Oh, we got everything in hand. There's no problem." I said, "You have it like hell." I said, "You see that man that had his hands down like this?" I said, "You see that big brass buckle he's got on there? That's what we call a belly gun. All he was waiting for you to stand right in front of him. He reached down, touched the button. The heavy cover would drop down, and three barrels of 22 shots would get you right in the belly." So while I'm telling them this, I'm watching the faces of the three SS, and I knew which one could speak English by the facial expression. So I suddenly turned to him. "Were you three back in that camp behind us?" "Yeah." And I searched for a question, because it was fruitless for me to ask them, "Why did you kill these people? Why did you brutalize them?" They didn't give a damn. So I asked them, I said, "Why didn't you at least control the diseases in the camp?" And he stood erect and he looked at me. He said, "Why the hell should we? They were all going to die anyway." And I had everything I could do to control myself and not kill him right there, because I believed in my own morals, that he was a prisoner, an unarmed prisoner now. And I would not go below that line, just because many people ask me, "Why, when you left Dachau 3B and went into the city, why didn't you kill every German you saw?" And I tell them, because the other guy had become an animal, and that's not an accurate description. Didn't mean that we young Americans should go below that line and become an animal too. An eye for an eye doesn't put a stop to anything. And that's what we believe we were over there in Europe for, is to put a stop to all that human misery. There were so much horrors, so much brutality over there, so much